It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound packs of juicy Kroger red, green, or black seedless grapes for $3.99 with your card and a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packs of flavorful Private Selection 80% lean Angus ground chuck for $4.99 each with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Chapter 12 of All the Brothers Were Valiant. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. All the Brothers Were Valiant by Ben Ames Williams. Chapter 12. The Nathan Ross changed course that day, and the word went around the ship. It passed from man to man. There was whispering, and there were dark looks flung toward Joel. Joel kept the deck all day, silent and watchful and waiting. Mark spoke to him once or twice, asking what he meant to do. Joel told him nothing. He had fought out his fight the night before. He knew himself. Mark and Finch talked together during the morning. Joel watched them without comment. Later he saw Mark speak to the other mates, one by one. At dinner in the cabin, the mates were silent. Their eyes had something of shame in them, and something of venomous hate. They already hated Joel, whom they planned to wrong. The day was fair, and the wind drove them smoothly. There was no work to be done, never a spout on the sea. Joel, watching once or twice the whispering groups of idle men, wished a whale might be sighted, and once he sent Morell and Vard to find tasks for the men to do, and kept them at it through the long afternoon, scraping, scrubbing, painting. Priss kept to her cabin. When she did not appear at breakfast, Joel went to her door and knocked. She called to him, "I've a headache. I'm going to rest." He ordered that food be sent to her. He stayed on deck till late that night, but with the coming of night the ship had grown quiet, and most of the men were below in the forecastle. So at last Joel left the deck to Vard and went below. He sat down at his desk and wrote up the day's log. Priss came to him there. She had been in bed, and she wore a heavy dressing gown over her night garments. Her hair was braided, hanging across her shoulders. She sat down beside the desk, and when Joel could fight back the misery in his eyes, he looked toward her and asked, "Is your head better?" She said very quietly, "Joel, I want to ask you something." He wanted her sympathy so terribly, and her tone was so cool and so aloof, that he winced. But he said, "Very well." "Mark says he asked you to take the Nathan Ross to get the pearls he left on that island. Is that true?"
"Yes," said Joel.
"He says you would not do it."
"I will not do it," Joel told her.
"He says," said Priss quietly, "that you are afraid. He says that was your own word when he accused you. Is that true?" If there had been any sympathy or understanding in her voice or in her eyes, he would have told her. Told her that it was for his ship and not for himself that he was afraid. But there was not. She was so cold and hard. He would not seek to justify himself to her. "Yes," he said quietly, "I used that word." She turned her eyes quickly away from his, that he might not see the pain in hers. She rose to go back to her cabin. As she reached the door, someone knocked on the door that led to the main cabin, and without waiting for word from Joel, that door opened. Mark stood there. He came in with Finch and Varde and old Hooper and young Morrell on his heels. Priss shrank back into her cabin, closed the door to a crack, listened. Joel got to his feet.
"What is it?" he asked.
Mark bowed low, faced his brother with a cold and triumphant smile.
"These gentlemen have asked me," he explained, "to tell you that we have decided to go fetch the pearls."
End of chapter 12. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 13 of All the Brothers Were Valiant. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. All the Brothers Were Valiant by Ben Ames Williams. Chapter 13. When Priss, through the crack in the door, heard what Mark had said, she shut the door of her cabin soundlessly and crouched against it, listening. She was trembling. There was a long moment when no one of the men in the after cabin spoke. Then Big Jim Finch said suavely,
"That is to say, if Captain Shore does not object."
Joel asked then,
"What if I do object?"
Mark laughed.
"If you do object, why, we'll just go anyway. But you'll have no share."
And surly Varde added,
"We'd as soon you did object."
Mark bade him be quiet.
"That's not true, Joel," he said. "You know, I wanted you in this from the first. Your coming in will prevent complications. With you in, the whole matter is very simple and safe. But without you, we will be forced to take measures that may be reprehensible."
Joel did not speak, and Priss, trembling against the door, thought bitterly,
"He's afraid. He said himself that he is afraid."
Dick Morrell begged eagerly,
"Please, Captain Shore, there's a fortune for all of us. Mr. Worthen would tell you to do it."
Joel said then, "I told Mark Shore in the beginning that I would not risk my ship. The enterprise is not lawful. The pearls were stolen in the beginning. Murder hung around them. Bad luck would follow them, and there are blacks on the island to prevent our finding them in any case."
"There's no harm in going to sea," Morrell urged.
"'Tis far out of our proper way. Wasted time. And the men should be thinking of oil, not of pearls." Mark laughed.
"That may be," he agreed, "but the men's thoughts are already on the pearls. They've no mind for whaling, Joel. They've no mind for it."
"I'm doubtful that what you say is true." His brother snapped angrily,
"Do you call me a liar?"
"No," said Joel gently. "You were never one to lie, Mark." And Priss, listening, winced at the thing which was like apology in his tone. She heard Mark laugh again, aloud, and she heard the fat chuckle of Jim Finch. Then Mark said, "It's well you remember that. So, will you go with us, or do we go without you?" There was a long moment of silence before Joel answered. At last he said, "You're making to spill blood on the Nathan Ross, Mark. I've no mind for that. I'll not have it, if I can stop it. So, I'll consider this matter tonight and give you your answer in the morning." "You'll answer now," Vard said sullenly. "There's too much words and words. You'll answer now." "I'll answer in the morning," Joel repeated, as though he had not heard Vard. "In the morning. And, for now, I'll bid you good night, gentlemen." Mark chuckled. "There's one matter, Joel. You've two rifles and a pair of revolvers in the lockfast by your cabin there. I'll take them to avoid that blood spilling you mention." Priss held her breath, listening. But Joel said readily, "Yes, here is the key, Mark. And I hold you responsible for the weapons." Her anger at Joel for his submission beat in her ears, and she heard the jingle of the keys and the scrape and ring of the weapons as Mark took them. He called to Joel as he did so, "They'll not leave my hands. Till the morning, Joel, my boy." The keys jingled again. Mark said, "We'll ask you to stay in the after cabin here till morning, and Vard will be in the main cabin to see that you do it." "I'll stay here," Joel promised. "Then we'll bid you good night." Priss heard Joel echo the words in even tones. Then the door closed behind the men. There was no further sound in the after cabin. She opened her door. Joel stood by his desk, head drooping, one hand resting on the open log before him. She went toward him, and when he turned and saw her, she stopped and studied him, her eyes searching his. And at last she said, so softly it was as though she spoke to herself, "All the brothers were valiant, Joel. Are you just a coward?" He would not justify himself to her. He could only remember the shadowed deck beneath the boathouse, Priscilla in his brother's arms. He lifted his right hand a little, said sternly, "Go back to your place." She flung her eyes away from him, stood for an instant, then went to her cabin with feet that lagged and stumbled. End of chapter 13. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 14 of All the Brothers Were Valiant. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. All the Brothers Were Valiant by Ben Ames Williams. Chapter 14. Joel lay for an hour, planning what he should do. He could not yield. He could not yield, even though he might wish to do so. For the yielding would forfeit forever all control over these men, or any others. He could not yield. Yet he did not wish to fight, for the battle would be hopeless, with only death at the end for him, and it would ruin the men and lose the ship. Blood marks a ship with a mark that cannot be washed away, and Joel loved his ship, and he loved his men with something of a love of a father for children. Children they were. He knew them. Simple, easily led, easily swept by some adventurous vision. He slept, at last, dreamlessly. And in the morning, when they came to him, he told them what he wished to do. "Call the men aft," he said. "I'll speak to them. We'll see what their will is." Mark mocked him. "Ask the men, is it?" he exclaimed. "Let them vote, you'll be saying? Are you master of the ship, man, or just first selectman, that you'd call a town meeting on the high seas?" "I'll talk with the men," said Joel stubbornly. Varde strode forward angrily. "You'll talk with us," he said. "Yes or no? Now, what is it?" They were in the main cabin. Joel looked at Varde steadily for an instant, then he said, "I'm going on deck. You'll come." Priss, in the door of the after cabin, a frightened and trembling little figure, called to him, "Joel! Joel, don't!" He said, without turning, "Stay in your cabin, Priscilla." And then he passed between Varde and Finch, at the foot of the companion, and turned his back upon them, and went steadily up the steep, ladder-like stair. Varde made a convulsive movement to seize his arm, but Mark touched the man, held him with his eyes, whispered something. They had left old Hooper on deck. He and Aaron Burnham were standing in the after-house when Joel saw them. Joel said to the third mate, "Mr. Hooper, tell the men to lay aft." Mark had come up at Joel's heels, and Hooper looked past Joel to Mark for confirmation. And Mark smiled mirthlessly and approved. "Yes, Mr. Hooper, call the men," he said. "We're to hold a town meeting." Old Hooper's slow brain could not follow such maneuvering. Nevertheless, he bellowed a command, and the harpooners from the steerage and the men from forecastle and foredeck came stumbling and crowding aft. The men stopped amidships, and Joel went toward them a little ways, until he was under the boathouse. The mates stood about him, the harpooners a little to one side, and Mark leaned on the rail at the other side of the deck, watching, smiling. The revolvers were in his belt, the rifles leaned against the after rail. He polished the butt of one of the revolvers while he watched and smiled. Joel said, without preamble, "Men, the mates tell me that you've heard of my brother's pearls." The men looked at one another and at the mates. They were a jumbled lot, riff-raff of all the seas, Cape Verders, Islanders, a Cockney or two, a Frenchman, two or three Norsemen, and a backbone of New England stock. They looked at one another and at the mates with stupid, questioning eyes, and one or two of them nodded in a puzzled way, and the Cape Verders grinned with embarrassment. A New Englander drawled, "Aye, sir, we've heard the tale." Joel nodded. "When my brother came aboard at Tubuai," he said quietly, "he proposed that we go to this island. I do not know its position." Mark drawled from across the deck, "You know as much as any man aboard, myself excepted, Joel. It's my own secret, mind." "He proposed that we go to this island," Joel pursued, "and that he and I go ashore and get the pearls and say nothing about them." Varde, at Joel's side, swung his head and looked bleakly at Mark Shore, and one or two of the men murmured. Joel said quickly, "Don't misunderstand. I'm not blaming him for that. You must not. The pearls are his. He has a right to them. What I want you to know is that I refuse to go with him and get them on half shares. I could have had half and refused. Now he has spread the story among you, and the mates say that I must go with you all and get the things." He stopped, and the eyes of the men were on him, and one or two nodded, and a voice here and there exclaimed in approval. Joel waited until they were quiet again. Then he said, "These pearls have cost life. At least 5 men and a woman died in the getting of them. If we had them aboard here, more of us would die, for none would be content with his share. It's in my mind that they'd bring blood aboard the Nathan Ross, and I have no wish for that. But first, how many of you are for going after them?" There was a murmur of assent from many throats, and Joel looked from man to man. "Most of you, at least," he said. "Is there any man against going?" There may have been, but no man spoke. And over Joel's face passed a weary little shadow of pain. For a long moment he stood in the sun, studying them. And they saw his lips were white. Then he said quietly, "You shall not go. The Nathan Ross goes on about her proper matters. The pearls stay where they are." He shifted his weight, looked quickly toward his brother. He was poised for battle. By the very force of his word, there was a chance he might prevail. He watched the men in whose hands the answer lay. If he could hold them. Hands clamped his arms, and Mark smiled across the deck. Finch and old Hooper on one side, Varde and Morrell on the other. And after the first wrench of his surprise, he knew it was hopeless to struggle, and stood quietly. Mark strolled across the deck, smiling coldly. "If you'll not go, Joel, you must be taken," he said. And to the mates, "Bring back his arms." Joel felt the cord slipped through his elbows and drawn tight and looped and made secure. Old Aaron Burnham pushed forward and tugged at them, and Joel heard him say, "They'll hold him fast, Captain Shore. Like a trussed fowl, sir. That he is." "Captain Shore?" That would be Mark, come into command of the ship again. And Aaron added, "I've set the bolt on his cabin door, sir. Not 5 minutes gone." Mark laughed. "Good enough, Aaron. You and Varde take him down. Varde, you'll stay in the after cabin. If he tries to get free, summon me. And treat Mrs. Shore with the utmost courtesy." Varde was at Joel's side, and Joel saw the twist of his smile at Mark's last word. For a moment, thought of Priss left Joel sick. He thrust the thought aside. They took him down into the main cabin, Varde ahead, then Joel, and old Aaron close behind, his hand on Joel's elbow. Priss met them in the after cabin, crouching in a corner, white and still, her hands at her throat. Her eyes met his for an instant before Varde led him toward his own cabin. Aaron, behind, looked toward Priss, and the girl whispered hoarsely, "Is he hurt?" "He is not," said Aaron grimly. "We were most gentle with the man, and he made no struggle at all." Varde thrust Joel into the little cabin where his bunk was, and Joel heard the snick of a new-set bolt on the outer side of the door. He was alone, bound fast. Before he left the deck, he had heard Mark cry an order to the man at the wheel. The telltale in the after-cabin ceiling told him the Nathan Ross had changed her course again, for Mark's Island. In the face of men, he had held himself steady and calm. But now, alone in his cabin, he strained at his bonds, lips cracking over set teeth. He strained and tugged. Hopeless. No, not hopeless. He felt them yield a little more. Then, with a tiny snap of sound, the coils were loose, and he shook the cords down over his wrists and hands. He caught them as they fell across his fingers, lest the sound of their fall might warn Varde in the cabin outside his door. And he was still stupefied by the surprise of this deliverance. He lifted the broken bonds and examined them. A single strand had yielded, loosing all the rest. And where it had broken, Joel saw, it had been sliced all but through with a keen blade. Who? His thoughts raced back over the brief minutes of his bondage. Who? No other but Aaron Burnham could have had the chance and the goodwill. Old Aaron. And Aaron's knives were always razor sharp. Drawn once across the tight-stretched cord, Aaron had freed him. Aaron! He remembered something else. Aaron's words to Mark on deck. I've set the bolt on his cabin door. Aaron had set the new bolt that was the only bar between him and the after cabin, where Varde stood watch. Aaron had set the bolt, and Aaron had cut his bonds. Therefore, the bolt must be flimsy, easily forced away. That would be Aaron's plan. A single thrust would open the way. He turned toward the door, then caught himself, drew back, dropped on the bunk, and lay there, planning what he must do. End of chapter 14. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 15 of All the Brothers Were Valiant. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. All the Brothers Were Valiant by Ben Ames Williams. Chapter 15. The discovery of Aaron's loyalty had been immensely heartening to Joel. If Aaron were loyal, there might be others. Must be. Not all men are false. He wondered who they would be. He went over the men, one by one, from mate to humblest foremast hand. Finch and Varde were surely against him. Old Hooper, he and Aaron were cronies, and the other mates had left Hooper somewhat out of their movements thus far. Old Hooper might be, give him his chance, on Joel's side. Old Hooper and Aaron. Two. Dick Morrell? A boy, hot with the wonder and glamour of Mark's tale, easily swung to either side. Joel thought he would not swing too desperately to the lawless side. But he could not be counted on. What others were there? Joel had brought his own harpooner from the Martin Wilkes. A big island black. A decent man. A chance. Besides him, there were three men who had served Asa Worthen long among the foremast hands. Uncertain quantities. Chances everywhere. But he must strike quickly. There was no time to sound them out. When his dinner was brought at noon, his broken bonds would be discovered. They would be more careful thereafter. 3 hours lay before him. He set himself to listen with all his ears, to guess at what was going on above decks, and so choose his moment. He must wait as long as it was safe to wait. He must wait till men's bloods ran less hot after the crisis of the morning. He must wait till sober second thought was upon them. But there was always the chance to fear that Mark might come down. He would not wait too long. He could hear feet moving on the deck above his head. The Nathan Ross had run into rougher weather with her change of course. The wind was stiffening, and now and then a whisk of spray came aboard. He heard Jim Finch's bellowing commands, heard Mark's laughter. Mark and Jim were astern, fairly over his head. There were men in the main cabin. The scrape of their feet, the murmur of their voices came to him. Dick Morrell and old Hooper, perhaps. It was through these men that Joel's moment came. Finch, on deck, shouted down to them. Mark had decided to shorten sail, ease the strain on the old masts. Joel heard Morrell and Hooper go up to the deck. That would mean most of the men aloft. The decks would be fairly clear. His chance. He wished he could know where Vard sat, but he could not be sure of that, and he could not wait to guess by listening. He caught up a blanket from his bunk, held it open in his hands, drew back, and threw himself against the cabin door. It opened so easily that he overbalanced, all but fell. The screws had been set in punch holes so large that the threads scarce took hold at all. Joel stumbled out, saw Vard on the cushioned bench which ran across the stern. The mate was reading, a book from Joel's narrow shelf. At sight of Joel, he was for an instant paralyzed with surprise. That instant was long enough for Joel. He swept the blanket down upon the man, smothering his cries with fold on fold. And he grappled Vard and crushed him, and beat at his head with his fists until the mate's spasmodic struggles slackened. Priss had heard the sounds of combat, swept out of her cabin, bent above them. He looked up and saw her, and he said quietly, "Get back into your place." She cried pitifully, "I want to help, please." He shook his head. "This is my task. Quick!" She fled. He lifted Vard and carried him back to the cabin where he himself had been captive. And there, with the cords that had bound his own arms, he bound Vard, wrist and ankle. And he stripped away the blanket and stuffed into Vard's mouth a heavy woolen sock and tied it there with a handkerchief. Vard's eyes flickered open at the last, and Joel said to him, "I must leave you here for the present. You will do well to lie quietly." He left the man lying on the floor and went out into the after cabin and salvaged the bolt and screws that had been sent flying by his thrust. He put the bolt back in place, pushed the screws into the holes, bolted the door. No trace remained of his escape. Priss stood in her own door. Without looking at her, he opened the door into the main cabin. That apartment was empty, as he had expected. The companion stair led to the deck. But he could not go up that way. Mark and Jim Finch were within reach of the top of the stair. He would be at a disadvantage, coming up to them from below. He must reach the deck before they saw him. He crossed the cabin to a lockfast and opened it, and took out the two pairs of heavy ship's irons that lay there. Spring handcuffs that locked without a key. He put one pair in each pocket of his coat. There was a seldom-used door that opened from the main cabin into a passage which led in turn to the steerage where the harpooners slept. Joel stepped to this door, slipped the bolt, entered the passage, and closed the door behind him. It was black dark where he stood. The passage was unlighted, and the swinging lamp in the steerage did not send its rays this far. The Nathan Ross was heeling and bucking heavily in the cross seas, and Joel chose his footing carefully and moved forward along the passage, his hands braced against the wall on either side. The way was short, scarce half a dozen feet, but he was long in covering the distance, and he paused frequently to listen. He had no wish to encounter the harpooners in their narrow quarters. He heard, at last, the muffled sound of a snore, and so covered the last inches of his way more quickly. When he was able to look into the place, he saw that two of the men were in their bunks, apparently asleep. The black whom he had brought from the Nathan Ross was not there. Joel was glad to think he was on deck, glad to hope for the chance of his help. With steps so slow he seemed like a shadow in the semi-darkness, he crossed to the foot of the ladder that led to the deck. The men in their bunks still slept. He began to climb. The ship was rolling heavily, so that he was forced to grip the ladder tightly. One of the sleepers stirred, and Joel froze where he stood, and watched, and waited for endless seconds, till the man became quiet once more. He climbed till his head was on a level with the deck still hidden by the sides of the scuttle at the top of the ladder. And there he poised himself. For the last steps to the deck must be made in a single rush, so quickly that interference would be impossible. He made them. One, three. He stood upon the deck, looked aft. Mark and Jim Finch stood there, not 10 feet away from him. Finch's back was turned, but Mark saw Joel instantly, and Joel, watching, saw Mark's mouth widen in a broad and mischievously delighted smile. End of chapter 15. Recording by Roger Moline.
Chapter 16 of All the Brothers Were Valiant. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. All the Brothers Were Valiant by Ben Ames Williams. Chapter 16. At the moment when Joel reached the deck, the other men aboard the Nathan Ross were widely scattered. Vard, the second mate, he had left tied and helpless in the cabin. Two of the four harpooners were below in their bunks, asleep. The greater part of one watch was likewise below, in the forecastle, and the rest of the crew, under Dick Morrell's eye, were shortening sail. In the after part of the ship there were only Mark Shore, Finch, a foremast hand at the wheel, old Aaron Burnham, and the cook. Of these, Mark, Jim, and the man at the wheel were in sight when Joel appeared, and only Mark had seen him. Joel saw his brother's smile, and stood for an instant, poised to meet an attack. None came. He swept his eyes forward, and saw that he need fear no immediate interference from that direction, and so he went quietly toward the men astern. The broad back of Jim Finch was within 6 feet of him. What moved Mark Shore in that moment is hard to say. It may have been the reckless spirit of the man, willing to wait and watch and see what Joel would do, or it may have been the distaste he must have felt for Jim Finch's slavish adulation, or it may have been an unadmitted admiration for Joel's courage. At any rate, while Joel advanced, Mark stood still and smiled, and he gave Finch no warning, so that when Joel touched the mate's elbow, Finch whirled with a startled gasp of surprise and consternation, and in his first panic tried to back away. Still, Mark made no move. The man at the wheel uttered one exclamation, looked quickly at Mark for commands, and took his cue from his leader. Finch was left alone and unsupported to face Joel. Joel did not pursue the retreating mate. He stepped to the rail, where the whaleboats hung, and called to Finch quietly, "Mr. Finch, step here." Finch had retreated until his shoulders were braced against the wall of the after-house. He leaned there, hands outspread against the wall behind him, staring at Joel with goggling eyes. And Joel said again, "Come here, Mr. Finch." Joel's composure and the determination and the confidence in his tone frightened Finch. He clamored suddenly, "How did he get here, Captain Shore? Jump him! Tie him up! You, Aaron!" He appealed to the man at the wheel, and to old Aaron, who had appeared in the doorway of the tiny compartment where his tools were stored. Neither stirred. Mark Shore, chuckling, stared at Finch and at Joel, and Finch cried, "Captain Shore! Come on, let's get him!" Joel said for the third time, "Come here, Finch." Finch held out a hand to Mark, appealingly. Mark shook his head. "This is your affair, Finch," he said. "Go get him yourself. He's waiting for you. And you're twice his size." Give Finch his due. With even moral support behind him, he would have overwhelmed Joel in a single rush. Without that support, he would still have faced any reasonable attack. But there was something baffling about Joel's movements, his tones, the manner of his command, that stupefied Finch. He felt that he was groping in the dark. The mutiny must have collapsed. It may have been only a snare to trap him. He was alone, against Joel, and with none to support him. Finch's courage was not of the solitary kind. He took one slow step toward Joel, and in that single step was surrender. Joel stood still, but his eyes held the big man's, and he said curtly, "Quickly, Finch!" Finch took another lagging step, another. Joel dropped his hand in his coat pocket and drew out a pair of irons. He tossed them toward Finch, and the mate shrank, and the iron struck him in the body and fell to the deck. He stared down at them, stared at Joel. Joel said, "Pick them up. Snap one on your right wrist. Then put your arms around the davit there and snap the other." Finch shook his head in a bewildered way, as though trying to understand. And abruptly a surge of honest anger swept him, and he stiffened and wheeled to rush at Joel. But Joel made no move either to retreat or to meet the attack. And Finch, like a huge and baffled bear, slumped again and slowly stooped and gathered up the handcuffs. With them in his hands, he looked again at Joel, and for a long moment their eyes battled. Then Joel stepped forward, touched Finch lightly on the arm, and guided him toward the rail. Finch was absolutely unresisting. The sap had gone out of him. Joel drew the man's arms around the davit and snapped the irons upon his wrist. Finch was fast there, out of whatever action there was to come, and Joel's lips tightened with relief. He stepped back. He saw then that some of the crew had heard, and three or four of them were gathering amidships, near the try-works. The two harpooners were there, and one of them was that black whom Joel had brought from the Martin Wilkes, and in whom he placed some faith. He eyed these men for a moment,
wondering whether they were nerved to strike. But they did not stir. They did not move toward him. And he guessed they were as stupefied as Finch by what had happened. So long as the men aft allowed him to go free, they would not interfere. They did not understand, and without understanding, they were helpless. He turned his back on them and looked toward Mark. Mark Shore had watched Joel's encounter with Finch in frank enjoyment. Such incidents pleased him. They appealed to his love for the bold and daring facts of life. He had smiled. But now Joel saw that he had stepped back a little, perhaps by accident. He was behind the man at the wheel, behind the spot where Aaron Burnham stood. He was standing almost against the after rail, in the narrow corridor that runs fore and aft through the after house. The pistols were in his belt, and the two rifles leaned on the rail at his side. Mark himself was standing at ease, his arms relaxed, his hands resting lightly on his hips and his feet apart. He swayed to the movement of the ship, balancing with the unconscious ease of long custom. Joel went toward him, not slowly, yet without haste. He passed old Aaron with no word, passed the wheelman, and faced his brother. They were scarce 2 feet apart when he stopped. And there were no others enough to hear, above the slashing of the seas and the whistle of the wind, his low words. He said, "Mark, you've made a mistake, a bad mistake, in starting this mutiny." Mark smiled slowly. "That's a hard word, Joel. It's in my mind that if this is mutiny, it's a very peaceful model." "Nevertheless, it is just that," said Joel. "It is that, and it is also a mistake. And you are wise men enough to see this. There is still time to remedy the thing. It can be forgotten." Mark chuckled. "If that is true, you've a most convenient memory, Joel." Joel's cheeks flushed slowly, and he answered, "I am anxious to forget, whatever shames the House of Shore." Mark threw back his head and laughed aloud. "Bless you, boy," he exclaimed. "'Tis no shame to you to have fallen victim to our numbers." But there was a heat in his tones that told Joel he was shaken, and Joel insisted steadily, "It was not my own shame I feared." "Mine, then?" Mark challenged. "Aye," said Joel, "yours." Mark bent toward him with a mocking flare of anger in his eyes, and he said harshly, "You've spoken too much for a small man. Be silent, and go below." Joel waited for an instant, then his shoulders stirred as though he chose a hard course, and he held out his hand and said quietly, "Give me the guns, Mark." Mark stared at him, and he laughed aloud. "You're immense, boy," he applauded. "The cool nerve of you." His eyes warmed with frank admiration. "Joel, hark to this," he cried, and jerked his head toward the captive Finch. "You've ripped the innards out of that mate of mine. I'll give you the job. You're mate of the Nathan Ross, and I'm proud to have you." "I am captain of the Nathan Ross," said Joel, "and you are my brother, and a mutineer. Give me the guns." Mark threw up his hand angrily. "You'll not hear reason." "Then go below and stay there, you—" There are few men who can stand flat-footed and still hit a crushing blow, but Joel did just this. When Mark began to speak, Joel's hands had been hanging limply at his sides. On Mark's last word, Joel's right hand whipped up as smoothly as a whip snaps, and it smacked on Mark's lean jaw with much the sound a whip makes. It struck just below the point of the jaw on the left-hand side, and Mark's head jerked back, and his knees sagged, and he tottered weakly forward into Joel's very arms. Joel's hands were at the other's belt, even as Mark fell. He brought out the revolvers, then let Mark slip down to the deck. And he stepped over the twitching body of his brother and caught up the two rifles, and dropped them, with the revolvers, over the after rail. Mark's splendid body had already begun to recover from the blow. He was struggling to sit up, and he saw what Joel did, and cried aloud, "Don't be a fool, boy! Keep them! Hell!" For the weapons were gone. Joel turned and looked down at him, and he said quietly, "While I can help it, there'll be no blood shed on my ship." Mark swept an arm toward the waist of the ship, and Joel looked and saw a growing knot of angry men there. "See them, do you?" Mark demanded. "They're drunk for blood. It's out of your hands, Joel. You've thrown your ace away. Now, boy, what will you do?" The men began to surge aft along the deck. End of chapter 16. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 17 of All the Brothers Were Valiant. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. All the Brothers Were Valiant by Ben Ames Williams. Chapter 17. The story of that battle upon the tumbling decks of the Nathan Ross was to be told and retold at many a gam upon the whaling grounds. It was such a story as strong men love, a story of overwhelming odds, of epic combat, of splendid death where blood ran hot and strong. There were a full score of men in the group that came aft toward Joel, and as they came, others, running from the forecastle and dropping from the rigging, joined them. Every man was drunk with the vision of wealth that he had built upon Mark Shore's story. The thing had grown and grown in the telling. It had fattened on the greed native in the men, and it was a monstrous thing now, and one that would not be denied. The men, as they moved aft, made grumbling sounds with their half-caught breath, and these sounds blended into a roaring growl like the growl of a beast. To face these men stood Joel. For an instant he was alone. Then, without word, old Aaron took his stand beside his captain. Aaron held gripped in both hands an adze. Its edge was sharp enough to slice hard wood like cheese. And at Joel's other side, the cook, a round man with greasy traces of his craft upon his countenance. He carried a heavy cleaver. There is an ancient feud between galley and forecastle, and the men greeting the cook's coming with a hungry cry of delight. Joel glanced at these new allies and saw their weapons. He took the adze from Aaron, the cleaver from the other, and he turned and hurled them behind him, over the rail. And in the moment's silence that followed on this action, he called to the men, "Go back to your places!" They growled at him. They were wordless, but they knew the thing they desired. The cook complained at Joel's elbow, "I could use that cleaver."
"I'll not have blood spilled," Joel told him. "If there's fighting, it'll be with fists."
And Mark touched Joel lightly on the shoulder and took his place beside him. He was smiling, a twisted smile above the swollen lump upon his jaw. He said lightly, "If it's fists, Joel, I think I'm safest to fight beside you." Joel looked up at him with a swift glance, and he brushed his hand across his eyes and nodded.
"I counted on that, Mark, in the last long run," he said. Mark gripped his arm and pressed it, and in that moment the long unspoken enmity between the brothers died forever. They faced the men. One howled like a wolf,
"He's done us in."
And another, "They're going to hog it, them two."
The little sea of scowling, twisting faces moved. It surged forward. The men charged, more than a score, to overwhelm the four. In the moment before, Joel had marked young Dick Morrell at one side, twisted with indecision. And in the instant when the men moved, he called,
"With us, Mr. Morrell!"
It was command, not question, and the boy answered with a shout and a blow. On the flank of the men, he swept toward them, and Joel's harpooner and one of Asa Worthen's old men formed a triumvirate that fought there. They were thus seven against a score. But they were seven good men, and the score were a mob. It was fists at the first, as Joel had sworn. The first charging line broke upon them, and old Aaron was swept back, fighting like a cat, and crushed and bruised, and left helpless in an instant. The fat cook dodged into his galley and snatched a knife and held the door there, prodding the flanks of those who swirled past his stronghold. Joel dropped the first man who came to him, and likewise Mark. But another twined round Joel's legs, and he could not kick them free, and there was no time to stoop and tear the man away. He and Mark kept back to back for a moment, but Mark was not a defensive fighter. He could not stand still and wait attack. And when his second man fell, he leaped the twisting body and charged into the clump of them. His black hair tossed, his eye was flaming, and his long arms worked like pistons and like flails. He became the center of a group that writhed and dissolved and formed again. His head rose above them all. The man who gripped Joel's legs freed one hand and began to beat at Joel's body from below. Joel could not endure the blows. He bent and took a rain of buffets on his head and shoulders while he caught the attacker by the throat and lifted him up and flung him away. He staggered free, set his back against the galley wall, and when he shifted to avoid another attack, he found his place in the galley door. The fat cook crouched behind him, and Joel heard him shout,
"I'll watch your legs, Captain. Give him the iron, sir. Give him the iron."
Once Joel, looking down, saw the cook's knife play like a flame between his knees. None would seek to pin him there. The black harpooner fought his way across the deck to Joel's side. He left a trail of twisting bodies behind him, and he was grinning with a huge delight.
"Now, sir, we'll do 'em, sir," he screamed.
The sweat poured down his black cheeks, and his mouth was cut and bleeding. His shirt was torn away from one shoulder and arm.
"Good man," said Joel, between his panting blows. "Good man."
Across the deck, one who had run forward for a handspike swept it down on young Dick Morrell's brown head.
Morrell dodged, but the blow cracked his shoulder and swept him to the deck. The man who had fought beside him spraddled the prostrate body and jerked an iron from the boat on the davits at his back and held it like a lance to keep all men at a distance. A sheath-knife sped and twisted in the air and struck him butt first above the eye, so that he fell limply and lay still. Mark Shore had been forced against the rail near where Jim Finch was pinned. Big Finch was howling and weeping with fright, and a little man of the crew with the rat's mean soul, who hated Finch, had found his hour. He was leaping about the mate, lashing him mercilessly with a heavy end of rope, and Finch screamed and twisted beneath the blows. So swiftly had the tumult of the battle arisen that all these things had come to pass before the harpooners asleep in the steerage could wake and reach the deck. When they climbed the ladder and looked about them, they saw Morrell and his ally prostrate at one side, Joel and the cook holding the galley door against a half-dozen men, and Big Mark's towering head amidst a knot of a half-dozen more. And one of the harpooners backed away toward the waist of the ship, watchful and wary, taking no part in the affair. But the other, he was a Cape Verder, black blood crossed with Spanish, and Mark Shore had tied him to a davit once upon a time, and lashed him till he bled for faults committed. He saw Mark now, and his eyes shone greedily. This man crouched and crossed to a boat, his own, and chose his own harpoon. He twisted off the wooden sheath that covered the point and flung it across the deck, and he poised the heavy iron in his hands and started slowly toward Mark, moving on tiptoe, lightly as a cat. Mark saw him coming, and the big man shouted joyfully, "Why, Silva! Come, you!" He flung aside the men encircling him. One among them held the handspike with which he had struck down Morrell, and Mark smote this man in the body, and when he doubled, wrenched the great club from his hands. He swung this, leaped to meet the harpooner. They came together in mid-deck. The great handspike whistled through the air and down. An eggshell crunched beneath a heel. Silva dropped. Mark stood for an instant above him, and in that instant every man saw the harpoon which Silva had driven home. Its heavy shaft hung, dragging on the deck. It hung from Mark's breast, high in the right shoulder, and the point stood out 6 inches behind his shoulder blade. It seemed to drag at him. He bent slowly beneath its weight, and drooped, and lay at last across the body of the man whose skull the handspike had crushed. There were at that moment about a dozen of the men still on their feet, but in the instant of their paralyzed dismay, two things struck them, two furies. Dick Morrell, tottering on unsteady feet, brandishing a razor-tipped lance full 10 feet long. He came upon the men from the flank, shouting, and Joel, when he saw his brother fall, left his shelter in the galley door and swept upon them. The fat cook, with the knife, fought nobly at his side. The men broke. They fled headlong forward, and Joel and Morrell and the cook pursued them through the waist, past the tripods, till they tumbled down the forecastle scuttle and huddled in their bunks and howled. A dozen limp bodies sprawled upon the deck, bodies of moaning men with heads that would ache and pound for days. Joel left Morrell to guard the forecastle and went back among them, going swiftly from man to man. Silva was dead. The others would not die, save only Mark. The iron had pierced his chest, had ripped a lung. End of chapter 17. Recording by Roger Moline. Chapter 18 of All the Brothers Were Valiant. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Roger Moline. All the Brothers Were Valiant by Ben Ames Williams. Chapter 18. He died that night, smiling to the last. He was able to speak, now and then, before the end, and Joel and Priss were near him at his side, soothing him, listening. He asked Joel once, "Shall I tell you where pearls?" Joel shook his head. "I do not want them," he said. "They have enough blood to turn them crimson. Let them lie." And Mark smiled and nodded faintly.
"Right, boy. Let them lie."
And his eyes shone up at them, and he whispered presently,
"That was a fight to tell about, Joel."
In those hours beside Mark, Priss completed the transition from girl to woman. She was very sober and quiet. But she did not weep, and she answered Mark's smiles. And Mark, watching her, seemed to remember something toward the last. Joel saw his eyes beckon, and he bent above his brother, and Mark whispered weakly,
"Treasure Priss, Joel. She's worth all. Kissed her, but she fought me."
Joel gripped his brother's hand.
"I knew there was no harm in you or in her," he said. "Don't trouble, Mark."
When old Aaron had stitched the canvas shroud, they laid Mark on the cutting stage, and Joel read over him from the book, while the men stood silent by. Chastened men, heads bandaged, arms in slings. Big Jim Finch at one side, shamed of face. Varde, sullen as ever, but with hopelessness writ large upon him. Morell and old Hooper. Joel finished, and he closed the book. "Unto the deep!" The cutting stage tilted, and the wave leaped and caught its burden and bore it softly down. The sun was shining, the sea danced, the wind was warm on fair Priscilla's cheek. And as though, the brief dramatic chapter being ended, another must at once begin, the masthead man presently called down to Joel the long droning hail,
"Ah! Blow!"
And he flung his arm toward where a misty spout sparkled in the sun a mile or two away. Minutes later, the boats took water, and the Nathan Ross was about her business again. Joel wrote in the log that night, with Priscilla beside him, her fingers in his hair. Priscilla had been very humble, till Joel took her in his arms and comforted her. He set down the ship's position. He recorded their capture, that day, of a great bull cachalot. And then, "This day, Mark Shore was buried at sea. He died late last night from wounds received when he fought valiantly to put down the mutiny of the crew. Fourth brother of the House of Shore." And below, the ancient and enduring epitaph, "All the Brothers Were Valiant." Priscilla, reading over his shoulder, pointed to this line, and whispered sorrowfully,
"But I called you a coward, Joel."
He looked up at her and smiled a little.
"I know better now," she said. "So give me the pen and close your eyes."
He heard the scratch of steel on paper, and when he opened his eyes again, he saw that Priscilla had underscored, with three deep strokes, the first word of that honorable line. End of chapter 18. Recording by Roger Moline. End of All the Brothers Were Valiant by Ben Ames Williams.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Fall into big savings, all in the Kroger app. Get 3-pound packs of juicy Kroger red, green, or black seedless grapes for $3.99 with your card and a digital coupon. Then get 1-pound packs of flavorful Private Selection 80% lean Angus ground chuck for $4.99 each with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.